Notre dernier conférencier de ce matin est Christophe Goydens de l'université catholique de Leuven. Alors, comme vous l'avez compris, Julie a fédéré tout un ensemble de projets de recherche autour d'elle, avec ce dynamisme qui la caractérise. Et c'est encore un autre projet de recherche que Christophe Goydens et cet après-midi Steven Kosemans vont représenter. C'est un projet dont elle a déjà évoqué le nom, Magister Dixit, un projet qui est donc établi à l'Université catholique de Leuven. Et il s'agit du dépouillement de carnets de notes d'étudiants de l'Université de Louvain du 15e et 16e siècle. Cette équipe de chercheurs a en effet découvert un fonds qui comporte plusieurs centaines, 500 carnets de notes d'étudiants. Et il y a tout un travail qui est en train de se faire autour de ces sources. Aujourd'hui, on en aura deux aperçus, dont le premier vous sera présenté sous le titre de « La logique à Louvain, entre environ 1425 et 1530, nouvelles perspectives de recherche ».
Merci beaucoup. Well, unfortunately, I will present this talk in English, so my apologies for that. The story of the fortunes of philosophy in northwestern Europe during the late medieval period is a story with many chapters. It's partly the story of the rapid expansion of the number of centers for the study of philosophy. At no point in history before the advent of modernity were more universities, studia generalia, founded than during the late 14th and 15th centuries. Jacques Vergier calculated that between 1378 and 1500, a striking 47 universities were either newly founded or restored, which amounts to roughly one new university opening its doors every 3 years. About one third of these foundations took place in the German speaking lands, and one of them occurred in the Duchy of Brabant, which in late medieval times covered parts of present-day Flanders, Wallonia, and the Netherlands, and which enjoyed considerable prosperity thanks to the trading activities in cities such as Brussels and Antwerp. In December 1425, through the instigation of John IV, Duke of Brabant, Pope Martin V commissioned the erection of a university in Louvain. The Louvain Studium Generale is the oldest in the geographical area that is today known as the Low Countries. Backed by the support of papal privileges, Louvain enjoyed a monopoly over university education in this region for more than a century, until the foundation of the University of Douai in 1559, during the Spanish reign. The story of late medieval philosophy in northwestern Europe is also, and perhaps first and foremost, the story of the Wegestreit, the story of the divide between realism via antiqua and nominalism via moderna. 15th century realists further developed the philosophical systems of the 13th century thinkers Albert the Great, Thomas Aquinas, and Duns Scotus. Nominalists continued in the footsteps of primarily, though not exclusively, William of Ockham, John Buridan, and the latest epigone, Marsilius of Ingen, three luminaries from the University of Paris during the 14th century. Both stories are intimately connected, since one of, if not the, most striking features of the 15th century Wegestreit was indeed its institutionalization. Most universities took sides, profiling themselves as standard bearers of either the realist or nominalist fraction. Louvain also took sides. Geographically situated in between Paris and Cologne, the Louvain Studium was modeled after the universities in these two cities. The teaching staff, during the years immediately following the university's foundation, was recruited almost exclusively among Paris and Cologne alumni. Although we unfortunately know nothing about these first professors apart from their names. The first edition of the university statutes, which was promulgated in 1429, amounts on several occasions to a literal copy of the statutes of Cologne. And due to its ties with Cologne and Paris, it's hardly surprising that Louvain profiled itself as being committed to realism. The Acta of the Arts Faculty contained a decree from 2 June 1427 stating that no master could be appointed as a lecturer in one of the four official arts colleges unless he had sworn an oath not to teach the doctrines of Occam, Buridan, Marsilius, or their followers, which de facto implied a ban on nominalist philosophy as a whole. This proposition was inscribed and further specified in the statutes from 1447, where it is stated that the principles of Aristotle's philosophy, whose corpus unsurprisingly formed the cornerstone of the curriculum at the arts faculty, should not be interpreted according to the views of Occam or his followers, neither according to those of the realist John Wycliffe, whose philosophy had recently been denounced as heretical at the Council of Constance. The edict goes on to list the autores probati, which are Albert the Great, Thomas Aquinas, Giles of Rome, and Averroes, although the latter's interpretation could only be sustained on those occasions when it did not contradict with Christian faith. Primarily on the basis of the institutional documents just surveyed, the communis opinio in the older 20th century literature holds that Louvain was a bastion of realist and especially Albertist philosophy, and construes Louvain as intellectually cognate with Cologne, Krakow, and St. Andrews. Some scholars have found support for this thesis in the fact that a few cases of doctrinal disobedience that have left some traces in the university sources of the arts faculty were met with harsh repressive measures. It concerns cases of members of the Louvain academic community being accused of having taught nominalist doctrines. Four such cases are known to date, and the most notorious one is no doubt the quarrel over future contingent propositions and the interpretation of Aristotle's On Interpretation, Chapter 9, which caused a stir in Louvain during the late 1460s and 1470s. Developing a kind of three-valued logic avant la lettre, the Louvain logician Petrus de Rivo had claimed that future tense propositions are neither false nor true, but neutral. This view, which had been defended earlier by Peter Auriol, was denounced by a Louvain colleague of de Rivo's, the theologian Henry de Zomeren. The matter escalated and reached Rome, and Peter was eventually asked by Pope Sixtus IV to dissociate himself from his position. In the 20th century literature, most notably in the studies by Ehler and de Jong, de Rivo's position is often presented as being inspired by nominalism, although the matter is still being debated. Calusa, for instance, pointed out that the Paris realists actually approved of de Rivo's position and considered his condemnation as a blow to their party. Two other cases are known from the bits that have been preserved of the Acta of the Arts Faculty. In November 1486, a professor named Marsilius of Arendonk was denounced for having claimed during a disputation that, quote, Aristotle was a nominalist, alongside several other things that go against the statutes of the faculty, unquote. About one decade later, in 1497, three masters were deprived from all benefices for a period of 3 years on the grounds that they had been teaching doctrines of the nominalists, quote, which the faculty has prohibited to be taught through many well-known ordinations, unquote. The thesis that Louvain was strongly committed to Albertist realism has been further consolidated by recent research. Studies by especially Mazzolini have pointed at the importance of both Thomist and Albertist philosophy as formative for the thought of Petrus de Rivo, and Papi has shown that the reconstruction of Aristotle's logic in the Commentarii Louvainiensis, which is an anonymous commentary on the Organon, which was first printed in 1535 and used continuously until 1568, was heavily influenced by Thomas Albert and to a lesser extent by Duns Scotus. Nonetheless, the Albertist thesis does not rest on steady foundations. And this is first and foremost due to the fact that arguably the most important sources for the reconstruction of the Louvain philosophical discourse during the late medieval period remain almost unstudied today, which are the textbook introductions to Aristotle's philosophy on the one hand, and on the other hand, the manuscript commentaries, lecture notes, on the Corpus Aristotelicum dictated ex cathedra by the professors and written down by the students. For the period 1425-1530, 18 of these commentaries have been preserved, 6 on Aristotle's natural philosophy and 12 on the Organon. As for the textbooks, we currently know of the existence of one fragment of handwritten commentary on Peter of Spain's Tractatus or Summulae Logicalis, which is datable around 1515, and 3 printed manuals, a survey of term logic from 1512 by Maarten van Dorp, an introduction to the Physica by Frans Titelmans, which was first printed in 1530, and an introduction to the Organon by the same author, which has been mentioned earlier today. My focus will primarily be on Louvain accounts of topical logic or dialectic, drawing on commentaries on the first book of Aristotle's Topics, which together with the second book was required reading in Louvain. I shall review the time-honored Albertist thesis expounded previously, primarily on the basis of one case study which addresses the Nachwirkung of Aristotle's dialectical syllogism, dialectikos syllogismos, and the question of the object of inquiry in dialectic. I shall argue that, contrary to what is commonly believed, there was a well-established nominalist subcurrent in Louvain from at least the 1470s until the 1530s. Aristotle's dialectic purports to offer a formalization of the dialogical debate between a questioner and a respondent. Its core notion is the dialectical problem, which in the light of Topics 111 should be understood as the exclusive disjunction of a proposition, a protasis, and its negation or contradictory, so P or not P, with not P being equivalent, of course, to it's not the case that P. Judging by Topics 2.1 and 3.6, P may involve quantification, but in most of Aristotle's examples, P lacks a quantifying expression. Either way, P can be described in terms of the propositions in the square of opposition, which you see printed over there. If quantified, P is syntactically either the A, E, I, or O proposition. If indefinite, P is semantically equivalent to, though not syntactically identical with, one of these propositions. Since P and not P are each other's contradictories, the following propositional typology is implied, and you see it down there. Aristotle specifies at Uninterpretation 17b that two propositions stand in a relation of contradiction if and only if they cannot both be true and they cannot both be false either. The predication in the disjunct P, not P, however, is perceived as doubtful, and therefore the question of the truth value of the disjuncts is subject to debate, with the two participants of the dialogue each upholding one disjunct as true. Let the disjunct chosen by the questioner be D1, and let the disjunct chosen by the respondent be D2. Topical logic provides the participants with a set of argumentative strategies, topoi, places or topics. The application of the topics to D2 will lead the questioner to the awareness of a number of propositions which he can use to argue that by maintaining the truth of D2, the respondent is led into contradiction, as it commits him to accept the truth of two propositions, Q and not Q, which cannot be true together. By arguing the falsity of D2, the questioner at once also establishes the truth of D1, which is precisely by virtue of the fact that D1 and D2 are mutually exclusive. As Slomkowski has shown, formally the arguments that build up to the contradiction Q and not Q will very often be a concatenation of hypothetical syllogisms, inferences in which the antecedent contains either a disjunction, a conjunction, or a simple conditional, so modus ponens, modus tollens. The propositions occurring in the antecedent are generally established through induction, which we read at Topics 8.1. Also notice that Aristotle barely uses the categorical syllogism in the Topics, save on some isolated occasions in the eighth book, which is often thought to have been written at a later date than the other books. Typical of the propositions yielded by the topical method is that they articulate endoxa, which Aristotle defines as notions that are, quote, accepted by everybody or by the majority or by the wise, that is, by all or by the majority or by the most notable and reputable of them. That is, an endoxic proposition articulates a certain aspect of the common body of knowledge. And the question of the truth value of endoxic propositions is irrelevant. They are endowed with a certain authority precisely by virtue of their prevalence. Aristotle uses the verb syllogizestai and its substantive equivalent syllogismos to denote the process of arguing the truth value of D1 and D2, claiming at topics 1.1 that dialectical syllogismos is the object of inquiry in dialectic. Syllogismos is defined very generally as an argument in which certain things being laid down, something other than these necessarily comes about through them. And this definition is almost identical to the one we find in the prior analytics, where syllogismos is described as a string of words and so forth. You can see it over there. It would nonetheless be a mistake to believe that both definitions grasp the same logical phenomenon. Syllogismos from the prior analytics covers the categorical syllogism, with syllogizestai being equivalent to deduce in syllogistic manner. The syllogismos from the topics, on the other hand, is very different. In the light of the sketch just given, we may refine Aristotle's definition of the dialectical or topical syllogismos as follows. Dialectical inference is an extended deduction which consists of a finite number of hypothetical syllogisms whose antecedent is established through induction, which is formulated to argue the truth of one member of the exclusive disjunction P or not P, whose propositions are endoxic statements and the properties of which constitute the object of inquiry in dialectic. Aristotle's notion of dialectical inference was subjected to a thoroughgoing reinterpretation in medieval logic. Throughout the medieval period, roughly from the 13th to the early 16th centuries, Aristotle's topics was accessed only indirectly, being read in the translation made by Boethius near the end of the 5th, beginning of the 6th century. In his translations of both the topics and prior analytics, Boethius rendered the terms syllogismos and syllogizestai with the Latin syllogismus and syllogizare, passing over rather than solving the equivocity of both terms. We shall see that this is not unimportant. At least one peculiarity of the medieval notion of dialectical inference is directly attributable to Boethius' choices of terminology. Boethius translated Aristotle's endoxon with probabile, a term laden with epistemic connotations, and this resulted in medieval logicians entertaining a notion of 1.3, which is the endoxic part, which differs considerably from Aristotle's. Dialectical inference became associated with probability, with the predicative relation in its propositions being described as doubtful but likely, so neither demonstratively true nor openly false. Moreover, 1.1 virtually disappeared, and with it the idea that dialectical inference is an extended deduction. And this is also partly due to the influence of Boethius, I think, and primarily of his De Topicis Differentiis, a treatise which Boethius claims draws on Themistius and purports to offer a systematization of peripatetic dialectic. The multi-agent context, we have seen, is the key to understand the properties of Aristotle's dialectical inference. The goal of dialectic is to provide an arguer with tools that he can use to lead his opponent into a contradiction. And to succeed, he will have to conceal his overall strategy and to unfold his argument carefully, with one step at a time. As long as we bear this in mind, it's clear that Aristotle's dialectical inference is the molecular concatenation of different atomic inferences. Each atomic inference, in casu a hypothetical syllogism, corresponds to one step in the process that leads toward the contradiction Q and not Q. The topicis differentiis proceeds from Aristotle's idea that dialectic revolves around the exclusive disjunction of two propositions, P, not P. But unlike Aristotle, Boethius does not frame his logic in the multi-agent context, focusing instead on the validity conditions of the different atomic inferences that are construed on the basis of the topics, and on the properties of the propositions of which these inferences consist. The topicis differentiis profoundly influenced the medieval debate on topical logic. Part of the logica virtus had been available to medieval logicians in days when Aristotle's topics were not. And this treatise shaped the medieval conception of the logical topics to the extent that when the topics resurfaced near the end of the 12th, beginning of the 13th century, the topicis differentiis provided the interpretative framework for this treatise. And this at least partly explains, I think, why medieval logicians, almost without exception, focused on the individual atomic inference as the most essential unit of Aristotelian dialectic, losing sight of the molecular structure of Aristotle's dialectical inference. Dialectical syllogismos came to be interpreted in terms of the definition of syllogismus found in the prior analytics, which resulted in the development of the dialectical syllogism, a kind of categorical syllogism whose propositions articulate probabilities. And being drawn into categorical syllogistic, dialectic became formalized. Aristotle, we've seen, had identified dialectical syllogismos, or syllogism, as the object of inquiry in dialectic. About all 13th century commentators on the topics known today, including the Louvain Probati Autores, Albert the Great, Thomas Aquinas, and Giles of Rome, endorsed this view. And the definitions are usually wrapped in hylomorphic terminology, a consequence of the resurfacing of Aristotle's Physica and Metaphysica in the 12th and 13th centuries. Which leads to the following definition. So, dialectical inference, dialecticus syllogismus, is a categorical syllogism with regard to its form, which is formulated to argue the truth of one member of the exclusive disjunction, which consists of probable propositions with regard to its matter and the properties of which are the object of inquiry in dialectic. Very similar definitions were proposed by the 15th century epigones such as Johannes Versoris, Lambertus de Monte, and Gerardus de Harderwijk. This account, which is clearly associated with realist logic, was criticized in nominalist circles in 14th century Paris. Rejecting the realist reinterpretation of Aristotle's 1.4, Parisian nominalists extended the scope of dialectical inference beyond the categorical syllogism, although they too construed it as an atomic rather than molecular entity. And this interpretation found its most articulate expression in John Buridan. It was later adopted by Marsilius of Ingen and Hartlevus de Marca, who studied in Vienna in the 1380s, a period when Buridan's philosophy enjoyed a certain popularity there. In the opening question of his commentary on the topics, Buridan subscribes to 2 and 2-3, but he expressly rejects 2-1, arguing instead that dialectical inference should be understood in terms of argumentatio. And the most elaborate discussion of argumentatio occurs in the 6th tract of Buridan's Summulae de Dialectica. And there Buridan uses the term to refer to the subset of assertoric inferences that are probative and where entailment is either necessary or probable. That is, an inference qualifies as an argumentatio even only if it succeeds in establishing the credibility of the consequent, on the grounds that the antecedent is epistemically primitive to the consequent and the inferential link between antecedent and consequent is evident, and b, if it takes the form of a syllogism, necessary entailment, formal consequence, antonym, example, or induction, which is probable entailment or material consequence. To qualify as dialectical, an argumentatio should satisfy the extra condition that its propositions are probable, so that it establishes opinion in the agent, and it gives us definition 3. Dialectical inference, argumentatio dialectica, is a syllogism, induction, antonym, or example with regard to its form, which succeeds in establishing the credibility of the consequent, 2, which is formulated to argue the truth of one member of the exclusive disjunction P or not P, 3, which consists of probable propositions with regard to its matter, and 4, the properties of which are the object of inquiry in dialectic. So it's worth noting that Buridan, like Aristotle, incorporated induction within the remit of dialectic, but that unlike Aristotle, he construes dialectical syllogism and induction in parataxis on the same level. The majority of the Louvain commentaries on the Organon that are known today subscribe to definition 2, the realist one, claiming that dialectical syllogism is the object of inquiry in dialectic. But 3 of them do not, and it concerns a commentary from 1496 by a professor called Hugo de Dordraco, about whom we know very little. A commentary from 1477, which originated also at one of the arts colleges, which was written by a further unknown professor called Theodoricus Meysach, and an anonymous and undated late 15th century commentary, which is today preserved in Aberdeen. In the 1477 commentary, this is the quote, the right quote, which is unfortunately only partially preserved, both definitions 2 and definition 3 are listed, and 3 is endorsed as true, while 2, which is expressly ascribed to Albert and Aquinas, is rejected on the grounds that it is too narrow in scope, since it excludes entomeme induction and example from the remit of the topics. A very similar argument is found in the Aberdeen commentary, which also lists both 2 and 3, then rejects 2 and subscribes to 3. The 1496 commentary is a bit more nuanced. Hugo first subscribes to definition 2, but then presents 3 as being equally probable. And the main argument in favor for 3 is again its broader scope. The question of the object of inquiry in dialectic is not a trivial one. Answering it amounts to defining the place of the topics in logic. And the fact that 3 of the Louvain commentaries on the topics known today define dialectic through a nominalist lens is therefore remarkable. What is possibly even more remarkable, however, is that these 3 commentators were not lonely birds, rather aves. In 1512, the Louvain logician Maarten van Dorp published in Paris a brief introduction to the properties of terms, Introductio facilis ad Aristotelis libros logicae intelligendos utilissima. The volume was written for the benefit of Dorp's students, and as mentioned, it is the oldest printed treatise on logic by a Louvain philosopher known to date. A cursory reading of the treatise, which, like the manuscript commentaries on the Organon, remains largely unstudied, reveals that the only contemporary logicians Dorp refers to are Occam, Summa Logicae and Quaestiones Quodlibeticae, and Buridan, Summae de Dialectica. About 20 years later, in 1533, Frans Tittelmans, who had lectured at the arts faculty during the early 1520s, published an introduction to the Organon, which contains many ideas that can be traced back to post-Buridanian logicians such as George of Brussels and John Dorp, although my time today is too short to go into the details. These data indicate that there was a tradition of nominalist logic in Louvain from the 1470s until the 1530s, which, apart from the few cases of doctrinal disobedience surveyed previously, left no traces in the documentary sources of the arts faculty known today. The date 1470 is necessarily a bit arbitrary, as it is determined by the sources at our disposal, which are unfortunately very fragmentary. But nonetheless, it's quite possible that this date is not entirely inaccurate. The 1460s witnessed a rise in popularity of nominalist philosophy in Paris, which eventually led to the notorious edict of King Louis XI in 1474. And given the close ties between Paris and Louvain, it's not unlikely that this surge of interest in nominalism in Paris triggered a similar development in Louvain, although I do not know of any evidence to prove this. Whatever the case, I hope to have shown that Louvain was less of a realist bulwark than is usually believed. Thank you for your attention.